know, refugees, asylum seekers, those we know. But it would be very difficult to plan around people you do not know because they don't exist on your record. That's the first thing. The second, and maybe we can collectively deal with cancer so that we comprehensively respond. Honorable members, you may want to know that we did an audit of cancer services in the country. And based on that, we looked at the number of personnel needed as in oncology and other related, like radiologists and so on. We also look at equipment that is needed, whether we have linear accelerators or not, and whether we have so... Dr. Jürgen Pile can just give you a status report per province. But I think what is important is for us to look at, in addition to having radiation oncology and also other interventions, we also looking at whether people can access therapeutic interventions. As you know, I might just use this as an opportunity to share a story, and maybe the SAPRA colleagues are here. We had some patients who were on oncology therapy, and this was based on medicines that they were accessing through Section 21, and they were paying. Section 21 is actually access to medicines that are not registered in the country, and they were paying about 5,000 per course of treatment, which course of treatment is supposed to run for a period of 6 months. Now, 5,000 per course of treatment, which was 6 months, it's probably affordable to a particular group of patients. But when the product got registered, it means the patients get put off the Section 21 program. And the registered product was out on the market for about, I think, 80? Yes. Almost. They had to pay about $1 million, between $800,000 and $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, between $75,000 and $80,000 per course of treatment for an individual.
Mm-hmm.
None of us in this room can afford to pay that. And it's those debates. And I think one is whether we have equipment and, you know, whether we've got oncology. But the other is a fundamental question about access to medicines and whether people can access affordable medicines. But Chair, it again presents another debate about cancer, hepatitis, and a few other conditions that require treatment. So we're working with Professor Freeman, who's patient. Actually, he's followed studies to look at what is affordable treatment for these patients. And it's those kind of discussions. I was just raising it because when you talk about oncology, you also have to look at what is it that is affordable and who can pay. Even the state cannot afford to spend that much per individual. Honorable members, the committees is another second issue that I would like to raise. That I think there's a general principle that we probably have to refer to. The Act is very prescriptive about how MECs must appoint committees and what the process should be and what the functions are. But I think the more key question is an important one to say, in terms of, you know, governance, number one, and number two, how we want our health systems to perform, whether clinics or hospitals, what is the best model of appointment of these people and the composition? Because, you know, you may want people who are local, but you have to look at what is it that you want to do. Is it just representation that you want? Or do you want people who are going to bridge a gap between the users of services and the service itself and ensure that there are proper governance arrangements and also ensure that you can get a mechanism of feedback loop by which services can improve? It's very difficult. And you know, for an MEC to be sitting waiting to hear a complaint about a clinic somewhere, a minister getting a complaint about a hospital somewhere, on a regular basis. I get SMS, somebody says, I've been here at this clinic, they locked me out. It's not practical. So those governance structures, if they work very well, they should actually serve their people. So the question is, you know, is it people who are in that committee, or is it just representation? And if we can answer that question, I think that will help. I mean, we've looked at options as to how best we can provide for this. A balance between making sure that there's local content while ensuring that you have capacity, people who can actually do the work. You know, they can read reports, annual reports, they can engage, they can meet with clinicians, you know. Some mechanisms that can help us make those committees work, and that would be what we propose. And the minister has also considered an option that if you want proper feedback, you must actually have, in your composition of the committee, there must be a user of services. You know, with the school governing board, it's good because you have parents who have interest in their children.
Yeah.
But here you can't say, you know, you have patients, because they are not always patients. You get sick at a particular point in time. So, but you must consider a patient group, let's say patient group of HIV/AIDS people living with HIV, because they will understand their experiences and be able to articulate. Or, you know, people hypertension, who attend hypertension clinics, who can then share their experiences, who must be part of the composition, because they can share their experiences. Those are some of the considerations that you can make. I would like to discuss the point about delegations and maybe take this opportunity to say we have actually done an assessment about delegations. There are two aspects to delegation. It's HR-related delegation and financial delegation. In terms of PFMA and the Public Service Act. And our proposal is that, you know, and I want us to differentiate that between a decentralized model of service delivery, because we are saying service delivery must happen at district level, and this is where we should put resources, as opposed to mechanisms of centralization, where you want to achieve economies of scale and reduce costs. So that we differentiate and also identify those areas where you do that. So in our response to that, what we did, we partnered with the Chief Procurement Officer and National Treasurer and did an assessment of five key strategic areas. The first one was on how we procure equipment. We're saying if you do local content in terms of equipment, I mean oncology equipment, nobody produces oncology equipment in a local community. So those kind of, you know, functions you may want to centralize and bring your experts to help you with that process. But where you want to buy food, why would you want to centralize the procurement of bread, lettuce? We even costed lettuce to say how much it is, and cabbage. So we differentiated between things that must be done locally to stimulate local economy, but ensure that you can help managers take decisions at that level, and those that must be centralized, so that there's a good tension between those kind of processes. We identified, laundry services, catering services, cleaning, equipment, and waste management. We said we have to look at those that must be decentralized and those that must be centralized, and where the capacity lies and so on. So that was one. And I just wanted to say that that report actually should be made available to Parliament so that you can read and see what work was done and what has informed those kind of decisions. I actually agree. Things like catering, cooking, CEOs must be empowered. They must make those decisions. You know, they shouldn't wait 6 months later to decide whether they should buy bread or not. And it's like changing clothes. There are these basic things where CEOs must be empowered to make decisions. The question about medical legal claims, yes, we, Ms. Rennie will tell you, we do have figures because we've been doing assessments about how much we spend, actually spend on medical legal claims. So what we were presenting here was to just say this contingent liability of 98 billion actually is not the correct figure. And we're differentiating between a letter of demand that has not translated into litigation versus the actual litigation where the summons have been served, matters have been put on the roll, so that we differentiate between those two. And we can come back and refer to that. And I agree with the chair that we have not shared with the committee that on the basis, in fact, you'll see those lawyers. I mean, it can't be that in this country it's only those lawyers who are interested in this matter. There are others that were frivolous and also, you know, to a certain extent involved in vexatious litigation. And we went back to sort of engage SIU. And one of the problems that we pick up is that some of the cases were fraudulent, in that they were claiming for patients that don't exist. Somewhere they just deliberately misled the court. So it's the basis on which the SIU engages in investigations in the Eastern Cape. But we're working in Gauteng, actually, we've had very interesting examples here, where they were claiming for a patient a patient that had already died, or in instances where they claimed for 8 million, and subsequent to that, the patient came back to demand money from government because they had never been given their claims, particularly for future medical costs. So we've done one or two things. One, there's been a proposal that because there's been collusion between lawyers and some of the officials, and some of the lawyers have shared this information with us. Secondly, we've got cases where in one province particularly, they serve as experts for the litigants, meaning the lawyers who are suing go to grab our officials to be their expert witnesses against the state. So it's something that you have to deal with. The second one is that we've recognized that 80% of the claims are on cerebral palsy. So the minister has just gazetted facilities where services should be made available for cerebral palsy because the significant proportion of the costs are actually about future medical expenses. And we're arguing that if costs are for future medical expenses, you should render those services. You should invest in those services and make sure that people who serve, in fact, from when they are born, make sure that those services should be available and avoid spending money on future medical expenses. That's the first one. The second is that the Justice Department made recommendations that you should go the mediation route and establish mechanisms by which you can engage with families and find some mechanism by which you can support them but respond adequately. The third is that of improving the quality of care so that we prevent some of these problems from occurring. Like I said, we've got this Lancet report where we're proposing that we should move forward in terms of implementation and we will probably have to share that report with yourself. The next one about the EMS services and the changing policy. Chair, we have an expert, Professor Wallace, based at UCT, who's done actually extensive work, and the minister appointed an advisory committee of experts in the country, and they have gone out to look at what is a good emergency medical service and what does that entail. And what we established Is that the BAS, the basic ambulance, BAA assistance? Some of them were a real concern. They were a real concern, and they were being produced in big numbers. And it became a serious statutory problem, but also a quality concern. You know, because there's a difference between somebody who has been doing work for 20 years and somebody who has just been produced who can't resuscitate the patient. And the risk between putting a lot of those who can't resuscitate and a few who have experience, and maybe it's a difficulty that we've had. And at this point in time, we're working with the provinces to look at what does it mean to implement this policy and some of the regulations that were passed by the National Health Council. And Chair, you referred to the mother-to-child transmission as well as the Mom Connect. You know, sometimes it's very difficult for us to blow our own horns. Perhaps it's better if it's MRC that says it and somebody else. In that case, maybe the public will believe us. We're just being humble, Chair. We would like to raise the point about the use of technology and technological advances that the member raised to get feedback. In fact, the minister has in his budget speech mentioned this, and we'd like to repeat that to say, as we speak, Chair, I didn't present the mobile technology. There's a mobile technology that has been developed. Initially, when it was tested, the CEO didn't like it because they thought it's a policing system for them. But the beauty about it is that you are loading non-negotiables so that immediately they can know that they are running out of milk, they are running out of panado, they are running out of services, and it can be a trigger for them to raise alarm bells. So it's been tested, and we'd like to just say this is for the CEOs, but we want a similar system for the user of services, where they can just through SMS or whatever mechanism to report back. So, but this is a work in progress, and it will be shared with the committee at an appropriate level. The question about, you know, this presentation, whether it's about the reorganization of the public sector in preparation for NHI, I must say that precisely because we did pilot, some of the work here that we are reporting on comes out of the work on the pilot. And Chair, I also brought with me the CCMDD report just to show you what has worked. But because we've not had an opportunity to read the evaluation report, one of the things that was highlighted in that report and about CCMDD, because if you recall, we had two approaches to this model. One approach was where we just had people collect medicines from different facilities, from doctor's rooms, a clinic, or even a church. But in Western Cape, they followed a slightly different approach, where they created employment for locals, where they used bicycles to deliver. But the difference is that the users have to pay, I think, about 20 rand for that delivery. So, but they do get their medicine. So that is a difference of a model. And if you do a comparative analysis, we have to look at which one is cost effective of the two. So it's one particular area, but this particular area where we started introducing various information systems, yes indeed, it is the preparation it was in preparation for NHI, including the way we were reorganizing the primary health care. I raised three particular areas, Chair. The community health worker program, ensuring that we've got enough nurses to strengthen our primary health care, and the Cuban doctors because of their strength in primary health care. Now, if we make investments at primary health care level, it should really show, because then fewer people must actually be hospitalized if we make those investments. And I think that's probably where the reorganization and how this approach should be considered. On non-communicable diseases, pollutants, I'll make an appeal. I said it in my last presentation, I'll say it again. And I know you made reference, Chair, to outstanding work on your part. And it's a humble plea from me about NAPISA bill. Chair, I'll raise it because Honourable Member referred to pollutants and whether the SO2 pollutant could be contributing to, you know, as a high risk factor to the Mpumalanga citizens. I would say that the disaster that happened in KZN yesterday, and this mercury, you know, the factory, this bill that is before Parliament, I can assure you, read the international health regulations and look at the obligations of South Africa as a country. And the fact that it is not and cannot be only about disease outbreaks. It is about chemical disasters, nuclear disasters. It's about areas where you have conflict and people migrate and end up with cholera, like we've seen in the border area with Zimbabwe. So all those issues, Chair, are matters that I would really humbly, Chair, put this matter again. We would have failed our people if we do not respond to this. Because at the moment, to just say IHR, International Health Regulations, we comply as a country and we tick a box, it is not enough. We saw with listeriosis, with the food-borne disease, that is precisely how you show how a country should respond. And now I'm using this instance in KZN, and I'm also referring to the pollutants in Mpumalanga, and of course the city to the coast as well. Now, when you have this mechanism by which you can do surveillance, you can know instantly as to which environmental factors contribute to your business. Allocation of resources and shortage. Well, Chair, what we did, and I just want to respond to the HR issues in particular. You know, it's always good, Chair, when you know that these are the number of health workers that you need, and this is how much it costs, and you plan around that. But it's also important to also reflect a bit to say, but are we using them appropriately? Because we've gone back, Chair, to insist on reprioritization. When we looked at provinces, we suggested as part of this reprioritization that perhaps the provincial offices must be reduced and we use the money and redirect them to hospitals. We've proposed that national departments should be reduced so that the money should be redirected to clinics and hospitals. So meaning you reprioritize within, and I think the minister has been the main driver of this, to say we're not going to go to Treasury to ask for more money. Go and reprioritize from within and redirect resources appropriately, particularly for HR. So what we've done as part of the reprioritization, the slide that I've shown, is that if we do that, Chair, we'll save 800 million, and that 800 million must be used as a basis of appointment. Just reorganizing the way you render services should help us reduce costs and redirect the costs accordingly. And we say reprioritize to appoint those important health workers that are needed. So as a principle, this is what is being proposed, Chair, and we started that, point. The one about males, Chair, and this is an acknowledgement and maybe an oversight. KZN is the only province that recognizes this problem of males not accessing services and not even going to our clinic. And they started a very innovative way of improving access so that males can be tested and put on treatment by using mobile clinics, as well as targeting very specific high burden areas as well as those areas where that is concentrated in with men, like your taxi drivers. Not that taxi drivers are only men, but we know that a significant number of drivers are men. So the services are put closer to where men work. And the data was shared with us by Caprisa, because they also did a follow-up study to look at whether did this have an impact or not. And I think from what we saw, because we're still going to publish this in a scientific journal, they could actually show a correlation between those tests, the reduction, because this must also be linked to a, we don't say sugar daddy, what is the problem? I don't know. Yeah, bless us. Old school, yeah. It was linked to the blessers. So they could show actually that in Kendrick and the population at younger women were at risk that the rates were going down. So you might want to read the journal and look at the results. The next year about the hospital information system, let me just say, Chair, on the mobile, I think it was on mobile services. No, Gauteng does have mobile services. Let me just confirm that most of the services are actually in municipalities, and in fact, metros. So what they do, when we ask for data, we get it from provincial health. We never get it, but perhaps because we've got SALGA as our member, we should include Gauteng. But it's not that Gauteng doesn't have. But it's an important point that the member raised. On the payment, I've heard what a member said, and we're just presenting this as an issue, but also ensure that we look at what is the best model, actually. One, because you don't want, you also want some aspects of altruism amongst our people, you know, and recognition that others may not have money even for sending SMSs. I mean, we've seen it with our community health workers. The involvement of ward councillors, I think maybe because you are members of parliament, you need to guide us about what safeguards do you want, you know, in this structure of committee. Safeguards that will ensure that they can perform their work, have independent and objective reporting. Whilst, you know, taking into account the services that people need. So that it's not just an opportunity for advancement of personal interest. And that safeguard is probably within the duty of Parliament to guide us as to the safeguards are needed for that purpose, particularly for these committees. The Nelson Mandela Fidel Castro program, it is an important program for primary health care. And what we have done, because we have engaged our local universities, it's not just a program that is completely independent. It has been integrated. And perhaps long term, we might want to look at whether our universities can recognize. And what the most significant thing I think that we've seen over a few years is that we're beginning to see decentralized a decentralized training platform, something that we're not used to. The students, former students of King Edward and Alan Taylor, what's the other UNB, yes, will tell you that it was only in our central hospitals, you know, Uvara, where training was provided. But now we're seeing decentralization, and it's a very important step, because this is where most of our doctors, and you know, our family medicine decisions are going to be key drivers of how training is done in a decentralized manner. And I think this student program has somehow opened our eyes and towards different approaches to training. But I think the point that is raised about long term, we might want, I mean, if you want to expand the platform, we might want to look at some training program where you also have Cubans train in South Africa and more South African learners benefit because you can't fly all of them to Cuba. It might be sort of some hybrid model that you think of long term. I'm happy about the nurses. And I would like to respond to the question about nurses. What actually happens with the nursing program? You know, we've got statutory bodies and accreditation bodies on the education side and on the health side. And, of course, you know, government has to deal with one cat, you know, because each institution thinks they are important and the other is not. So we have to call everyone in one room. And bring to their attention that we are running the risk in this country that if we don't resolve these matters, that we won't have students, you know, intake for January. So what has happened, Chair, is that we've agreed on a process flow whereby the first group of colleges that are ready, because the error, I think, was with what the criteria has been. Because CHE did not have any recognition of nursing in the public sector. They just had every nursing college as private. Council for Higher Education. Yes. So what they did, they just had every college as private. So we explained that, no, these are public sector colleges. And I think they've since corrected that. So what we awaited is for the Minister of Higher Education to gazette. And just based on gazetting, it will be the basis on which CHE accredits, and the nursing council must work with CHE and SACWA. So those three institutions must work hand in glove. And at least we've come to that agreement, we're getting them to sign MOUs, and this, we've got drafts that are being developed, and hopefully by end of September those should have been finalized, because students need to start applying so that by October we know how many are ready to be taken on board in January. So fortunately we have intervened and that process is underway. Chair, with regard to accreditation, I've referred to that. The guidelines on rape, sexual assault, and systems of monitoring. Honourable members, you'll recall that we used to have Tutuzela facilities that were funded by donors, and we have always argued that we probably need to have a much more sustainable model of financing, so that they're not just funded through donor funding and donors and their funding a program and the services collapse. So that's the first thing. So we've been looking at whether should these fall under health, or because they were driven mainly by the prosecuting agency. And NPA, when we met with them initially, they were more than welcome to hand these services over to us. But you're asking a very important point about the system of monitoring. I must say that up front, we have not set it up as yet. And maybe Dr. Pile will sort of respond as to what is the best we have in plan. The delegations, honorable members, like I said earlier, would like to have delegations to CEO, so that if a globe is broken, a window is broken, they must be able to fix it. If there's no bread, no telegraph, they must be able to buy. Meaning, those delegations are essential and they should be allowed. But like I explained, the proposal that we worked on with the Chief Procurement Office, you know, with Treasurer, were meant to differentiate between things that are on high end, high tech, and how we build capacity in the country and who has capacity, and then things that are for local, that can also support local economies and so on, so that we differentiate between the two. That is one, but I think your question was more about the services. If you refer to this, maybe Dr. Pili will explain the procurement, the centralization of procurement and what is intended later. I will of course make available the evaluation report, the appraisals like it was requested, as well as chair the market inquiry. It would be good to read all of these reports together. The vacancies, like I said, we will present a plan, and Dr. Andrew, maybe you want to spend a minute just to talk about our approach to the human resource for health strategy and what is different this time around and how do we hope to deal with all these complex HR problems. Refurbishment, yes. Honourable member, they all was all. What we've done, we said all. No? And I'll explain why we said all. And I know and I understand your point. Why we said all? Because we wanted to say upfront, when you allocate, right? Allocate and have a sense of how much money you need. So that you can say, okay, over a 5 to 7 year period, I will have a list of what I call priority facilities that we have to do. But as you do that, you also say, in between, you must still maintain these other priorities. Because I think the risk of just planning for building new and leaving what you have and they deteriorate is a lesson that we've learned. So our all was just to make sure that the impression must not be created that we just focus on new for replacement and then we leave those that need to be maintained. I think hence the word all, it was just to make sure that we sort of were comprehensive in approach. The electronic health record. Yes, actually, if you look at our data, and I want to use this, and it will be probably a bit graphic, just to give you a sense of what amount of work went into this. You know, we equated chair to a car. People who buy a car on installment, after 5 years, when it has done 100,000 Ks, they replace it. We did 200,000 of travel. 200,000 of travel in moving from facilities in even the most remote areas. And I understand fully what you mean. When you say some facilities, electricity, you know, it's they don't have adequate, in fact, connectivity. It's not even in the remote area, even in urban settings. It's still a concern for us. So we've done that. But we are also of the view. And I want to use the experience of the mobile technology chat. You know, if we just said we'll wait for everyone to have a telephone in their household, you know, I think we'd wait another 100 years. But today I can safely say that the mobile technology changed people's lives. It started with it being a telephone, a communication tool, and now it has become a music tool, a movie tool. It has transformed. Now I want to say that perhaps we need to move our health system to that era where we move from just having a computer on a desk to helping a doctor make decisions better and so on. And this is where we want to move with information systems and digital health. And I know maybe it's sort of a little bit ambitious, but it's probably what we need. And look at how best we invest in this. This is the reason why when we assessed our facilities, and maybe I can share with members, when we did the assessment, we developed norms and standards. assess all the systems we have. And I can say that we even found in our facilities systems that still ran on micro, what are they? Word perfect. And DOS. Now, can you imagine in this day and age, DOS and Word perfect. So we said, you see, unless we intervene, people will continue to think that's all there is. In the meantime, some have leapfrogged, and that's what we'd like to see happen. So we would like you to travel with us in this journey of making the South African health. And I'm pleased to say, Chair, Eastern Cape, with compliments, Chair, has been the only province in the country that employed programmers. What they did, they developed their health information system. And we've asked that there should be no intellectual property, they've agreed. KZN, as I speak, has gone to Eastern Cape to see whether they can copy and paste at no cost. So what we would like you to do is to hold us accountable and say, don't go spend another cent on buying systems. When Eastern Cape has done it, and KZN has been copy and paste, then I'm now agitating for you to say we shouldn't spend money there. Rather use the money to employ more doctors and nurses, Chair. Patient experience of care.
Gigi, don't hide. Tell them, Fire Hospital. What hospital?
Okay. Dr. Pile will refer to that and give them a chance. And Dr. Andrews will talk about patient experience of care. Chair, the next one about, medical equipment and plans. Yes, what we've done is that this is what is needed in the country in terms of medical equipment. And the list is not exhaustive, but it's just the beginning of a process where we at least need to know, where the problems are so that we plan for them. Because as we prepare for NHL, we have to fix equipment, we have to buy new equipment and so on. And it is for that reason we did this analysis, and we'll share the plans with you as well. Overdue accounts and amounts, the CFO will respond, including the use of a private contractor. Chair, can I take a bit of a pause and ask my colleague to respond? Dr. Pile and Dr. Yoga, Pile followed by Dr. Andam Pile and Dr. Andrews and then the CFO. Then I'll continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, honourable members. Let me start with cancers. We'll prepare a comprehensive report because, as you would notice on the slide, that report is rather dated. It was a 2017 report, but the latest data there was 2015, 2016. But just to inform members that in the National Tertiary Services grant of this year, we've made provision for a number of linear accelerators. Charlotte Baker, for example, will have an additional linear accelerator, which should be operational sometime in October this year. The same with Petersburg Hospital in Limpopo, December this year. They've also outsourced last year and this year some of the services for radiation to an accredited provider in Petersburg, in Polokwane. In the NTSG, we've made provision for additional linear accelerators at Universitas and BECO as well, and a planning workstation at Freya Hospital. In Northern Cape has been preparing a bunker, so we hope that we'll be able to, in the next year or so, get them the linear accelerator they need. At the moment, they've contracted out in Kimberley to a private accredited provider. Rob Ferrer, as you would have heard recently, has started chemotherapy at Rob's, so that patients don't have to go to Steve Biko for chemotherapy. So that's a big plus for patients living in Mpumalanga. And Amtata has also now got a mixer, so they're providing chemo as well. So patients don't have to go all the way to Freya any longer for ongoing chemotherapy. So we'll provide, Honourable Member, a detailed description of both chemo and radiation province by province for you, which is an update. And as I think members know, last year former minister and the former MEC launched a cancer campaign to highlight the importance of primary prevention as well as early detection, including breast exams, etc. So, you know, we are increasing our investment in cancers. The audit that was done in 2017, when we costed it for both human resources and machines, came to R1 billion. Now, you know, when we went to Treasury to ask for R1 billion, you would guess what they told us. Mm-hmm. But they have been giving us smaller amounts of money through the NTSG, for example, and the NHI grant to focus on the backlogs on the cancers. We are also improving our surveillance on the cancers through the National Cancer Registry, and beyond the lab-based, pathology-based registry, we are also, with the NICD, expanding community-based surveillance. With one site now in the Kuruleni, and we are hoping to improve on that. So there are a number of things that we are doing. Are we there yet? Clearly not. Are we on our way? I would say yes. With respect to the issues raised around contributory factors to diabetes, as a member of. So there's gestational diabetes, type 1 diabetes, and type 2 diabetes. So there's a different. These are three different types. Gestational is during pregnancy, and the number of risk factors there. Type 1, not really known what the causes are, but they're largely around genetics and around some environmental issues. So clearly, with the MRC and others, we would have to look at whether or not some of that is related to diabetes, and some of the environmental factors in Mpumalanga are related to increased diabetes. But first we'll have to see if there's actually really an increase in diabetes and it's related to is it type 1, type 2, etc. Type 2, the some of the risk factors include what we ate at lunchtime, all the really oily food, all the wrong things, unfortunately, and of course sitting in a meeting for hours and hours with no physical activity. So some of we're the cause of some of our own non-communicable diseases. We're risk factors, yes. The committee is part of the risk factors. So there are things we can do about some of the non-communicable diseases, you know. And what we've done from the department, and now just not diabetes but NCDs broadly, the sugar tax is one thing, and we can see that there is starting to be a reduction in the consumption through sales figures of sugar-sweetened beverages. We are working with the unit at WITS to monitor what's happening and what the impact of the sugar tax is on changing our behavior. But if you saw people drinking Fanta earlier, like my colleague there, has, you know, probably close to 8 to 10 teaspoons of sugar in that Fanta that he was drinking. So we're doing all the wrong things, unfortunately, you know, personally, but at least on the regulatory side, we're doing the right things. We also, as you know, have regulations around salt and trans fats. So there are a number of things we're doing at the regulatory level. We're also working with the industry, the food and beverage industry, to try and get them to create an environment, a food environment, that would help individuals make the right choices. But ultimately, of course, it's up to the individual as well as modeling by parents and politicians, because you are leaders in society, etc. So there are a number of things we're doing around the NCDs, and not just diabetes. The DG is right around the issue of how are we monitoring the national guidelines on rape and sexual assault. We are not there yet. The only things really we are focusing on is providing comfort packs as well as post-exposure prophylaxis. But I fully agree that there's more we can do there. But clearly what we need to do is change the way our society runs. We can't have people just going around raping people, assaulting people sexually, etc. And I think that, you know, while we can deal with the survivors of rape, we need to prevent it from happening in the first place. And we really, honourable members, are not doing a good job there. So we clearly need to do a better job on our side, but that's only with the survivors. We've got to do a preventative job. On the issue of Mum Connect, honourable chair, this year is the fifth anniversary of Mum Connect. It was started in 2014 in August. So on the 4th of October, the minister will have a small event in Gauteng, in Soweto, as the kind of an anniversary, but he will also, as the DG suggested, announce a few other technological interventions that will decrease the distance between our patients and health services, because that really is what the key is to the use of technology, is to make it easier for patients to not only complain but access services and get advice about, as the chair said, about their own health in their homes rather than always needing to come to our health services. I'll stop there, DG and Chair. Thank you very much. On community health workers, I mean, as the slide suggests, we have 51,000 currently. The minister in his budget speech said we would add another 5,000 in this financial year, so we're working on that. But in order to do that, we are mapping, I think that's what the chair was alluding to, mapping where we need them against the burden of disease. So that, because historically, I think it was done quite randomly. It was done locally, quite randomly, and there was really little match between where we needed them and how many there were appointed in those particular wards. So we are mapping, we are retraining them. So the package of interventions for community health workers now is fairly narrow, and it's focused on the burden of disease. So maternal and child health, HIV and TB are the real core focus of community health workers. The one thing the minister will announce at some point fairly soon is he would like them to also focus on hypertension. Because about 50% of people in South Africa who are hypertensive don't know they are hypertensive and don't get access to treatment. Of those that know and get on treatment, about only 30% are controlled. So we have a big problem with hypertension, and the same numbers almost apply to diabetes. So the minister wants us to look at how community health workers can also engage communities around the NCDs, starting with hypertension or blood pressure. So I'll stop with you. Thank you.
Anvan Pibe.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the question was about procurement. Yeah. So currently what we do in the department is we do market intelligence for products. So in other words, we'd understand what products suppliers are available and what products they produce and the capacity to produce. We would then do the specifications, in other words, describing the product, the volumes that we want. We then put together a tender, advertise that, and then do the award jointly with our provincial colleagues. Once the award is done, the provincial departments will do the purchasing. In the NHI environment, that won't change very much because the facilities will continue to do the ordering and paying. The centralization will be for suppliers that would have a national footprint, like your medical, your medicine producers or your equipment producers, etc. But at a local level, those facilities will still be responsible for things like catering, security services. Those are all local level services. So they don't have a national footprint. So that's the way the procurement will be dissolved. But maybe tomorrow we'll also tackle that.
Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. I think, DG, I'll start with the patient experience of care question that the Honourable Member asked regarding, you know, how come there's this discrepancy between the real lived experience and tacit knowledge you have of what people experience compared to the results of the patient experience of care survey. I think it will be important to point out that both the patient experience of care survey in the hospital as well as patient experience of care survey in the primary health care facilities were commissioned to independent organizations whom the department worked with in overseeing the study, because it's our responsibility we commission work to ensure that they're doing the work we ask them to do. So, both these studies had very rigorous research methodologies. They were a sample of patients in facilities at primary health care level. And for the hospital survey, it was patients who were in hospital in various areas of hospital, from outpatients right through to maybe a surgical ward or whatever. And overall, it's always surprising to all of us that the patients who attend our hospitals and clinics, when they have to report on the experience of care, have very positive overall the level of patient experience is positive. It's almost always around 70% on average. And then when you look at population-based household surveys, which is done by Statis A, the general household survey, you will find an even higher level of reported satisfaction with patient experience of the care provided to them. There are, however, variances across different areas, like waiting times, maybe more positive in some areas than in others. In the one Gigi showed here, for example, there was a waiting level of satisfaction with waiting times was 52%. Now that resonates with us because, you know, people are not happy with the times they have to wait. And there can be many reasons for this. Sometimes, when people are asked questions, they respond to it. Sometimes they feel they must answer more positively. Sometimes it's really what they feel. All I can say is this is the result of an independent survey, and it is repeated in other kinds of surveys by other organizations like Statis. Then, Didi, on the HRH, I think Didi has responded to most of the questions related to HRH, human resources for health. So I'd like to outline, as Didi asked me to do, our approach to developing the new human resource for health strategy this time. I think I'll start by saying that the Minister of Health established a committee, a human resource for health ministerial advisory committee, to oversee the development of the new strategy, given that we had a strategy before, but somehow we don't move to full implementation of the strategy. What we then did was to divide the overall committee into different work streams so that these members were all deployed to the following work streams. One work stream looking at how do we estimate how many health professionals or what the health workforce, how do we estimate what the health workforce should look like by 2030, and then to do costings and projections on this. Then another work stream looking at issues related to leadership and governance and management, because we know there are many challenges around it. Then one work stream looking at the education and training of health professionals across the board. Another work stream looking at creating positive practice environments for health professionals. So looking at all workplace related issues, whether the conditions of service are fine, whether they have the equipment they need, etc. And then lastly, another work stream looking at how we're going to actually go in to monitor and evaluate the implementation of the strategy. Then within every work stream, we also have a member from the Department of Health working with the teams that were appointed based on their level of expertise or relevant expertise related to all these areas. So that it can be owned and institutionalized in the department, and the department can truly be the custodian of the new strategy. Another difference in approach compared to previous strategies for human resources files is that we're going to have a strategy with a longer time horizon up to 2030, but we're going to have a five-year plan to implement the first 5 years, and then for the next 5 years, another detailed plan on how to implement it. And the five-year plan will be very detailed, and it will be costed so that we can ensure we have the resources to implement the strategy. Concurrently, we are also doing an investment case, which we will present to Treasury, whereby we will present the health workforce, not as an expenditure against our budget, but as an investment in health and development, because that is what is shown in the literature and what we know from work done globally, that if you invest in your health workforce, the benefits go way beyond providing health services. It actually has benefits for overall health and development. So I think that's the key difference. I'd like to point out.
And further on to refer to the committees that are functional and any EMS related questions.
Thank you, Chair and Honorable Members. In terms of maybe let me start with the, there was a question relating to which training institution or which facility is not functioning within the issues of emergency, which province that does not have the accredited facility. So that province is Mpumalanga province. The challenge there was, you know, that in terms of the systems, HPCSA has to go and do the assessment of all facilities. So when they visited Mpumalanga province, they found that that facility does not meet the expectations. So in terms of the recommendations that have come through, that has been escalated to the province and has been given assurance that by December that facility will be accredited for emergency services. Then when it comes to committees, clinic committees, we must agree that we do have a challenge. We have done the process of assessing all these clinic committees throughout the country. So about 3,200 of them have been assessed, but in terms of functionality, we've got about 290 that are functional, which is a serious challenge on our side. That is why then we are embarking on the process of training. And there is a process of training the trainer within the provinces, and this is what we are embarking on, and we are monitoring the situation out there. But we do have a system, a challenge in terms of the functionalities of the committees.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
And thank you, Chair. I'll just touch on the flow of funds. So, obviously, the provinces decide on allocations through a provincial equitable share. So sadly, we don't decide, you know, what provinces should get. We obviously do try and influence it through the equitable share formula, that we show the percentages as a percentage of total budget. But those are not gazetted, so they, you know, arbitrary percentages, and provinces can decide to use them or not to use them. So obviously we then condition certain expenditures, HIV grant, NTSG, training grant, etc. But see, what we have found in some provinces is that because the money flows into the provincial treasuries, sometimes it doesn't flow through to the provincial department of health. So we've been monitoring that quite significantly the last two financial years. We've had some improvements. Provinces also have their own cash flow issues provincially, which then, you know, kind of use the funds for something else other than health. We've addressed that to a large extent. So that also addresses the flow of money, the spider kind of slide that was there that shows the flow of money. We've also attempted to ring fence or get provinces to ring fence funds within the provinces, which you call the non-negotiables. You refer to those, and that's a number of expenditures, anything from waste to blood to laboratory to cleaning services to medicines, vaccines, etc. But the difficulty with that again is that as soon as the province gets into cash flow difficulties, they move these funds around and they don't get to, you know, for instance, medicines. So we're looking at the next round of soft, you know, getting a soft kind of conditional grant framework that we call earmarked funds. That it's part of it gets gazetted, but it's not a firm budget. Anman's team is also working on to tell provinces that this should be a budget for, say, pharmacies or for medicines, for instance, you know, using the data that we have available. The fiscal constraints we showed there comes from the Treasury guidelines that says we need to cut 5%, then 6%, then 7% over the MTF period. So we were just trying to illustrate that if we go with that, what the impact would be. So that impacts all departments provincially as well as nationally, which by implication means that it impacts on the conditional grant allocations to provinces, which is actually a double whammy. And it also would impact on all our NGOs and public entities. They won't be exempted from this cut if it goes through. So for the first two financial years, that impact on the crude numbers we have is 11 billion and 14 billion. So that's what we're trying to show there. We obviously had discussions with Treasury through a process we call MTEC, an MTF process, which we engage them on. And hopefully when we look at our conditional grants and we reprioritize, We will also find a mechanism of strengthening provinces, and looking at some of those frameworks, we feel that, that some of the funds can go directly to provinces. No need for it to come through an indirect mechanism, for instance. So we're discussing that, that with Treasury. The issue of the outstanding amounts to staff, that's a contingent liability that exists at the moment. You can also call it an HR accrual if you like to do that. And what the DJ tried to show there was, what is the labor action that flows from the inability of provinces to, for instance, pay a full PMDS, and the others would show what would the liability be on leave accruals and leave liabilities, etc.
Thank you, Chair. Just maybe a few questions. The one about the health normative standard framework, I just wanted to explain to the member that there are two aspects to this. The first one is about functionality. And in our slides, what we are trying to demonstrate is that more than half of those systems that we assessed scored higher than 80%. So they're fine in terms of function. The problem with those that you refer to is their readiness. And this is with respect to compliance, that more than 70% scored below 50. It was when we were testing about their level of readiness. Now, if you want, so it means we'll have to go back to these and decide whether you want to make an investment in these to make sure that they can be upgraded and they're at a level that you want. Or do you want to rather go back to these that are good and then you expand them? Like I said, the beauty is that Eastern Cape employed programmers and they developed systems. So perhaps you can just do the copy and paste as I was suggesting. You didn't have to pay huge sums of money, to private contractors. They employed people full time in house to do this work. And it might be an option to deal with this problem. So the next question here about the antenatal visit and 20 weeks, your question was, maybe let me go back to the one about no school. Chair, when we look at the social determinants of health, I think one of the things that we look at, if you are going to come up with a health education and literacy program, you need a certain level of literacy so that your messaging can be appropriate to particular groups of people. And when we look at these social determinants of health, and I know that Chair was saying, everybody must go to school, but of course we know there's a company. Particularly, you'll see in history, some of the cases where women had to, particularly the child-led households, they had to forego going to school because of the ravages of HIV and AIDS. They had to look after their siblings, they had to look after their families. So they've missed out on learning. Perhaps we need to say, what is it that we must do to get them to catch up and to support them? But also to look at, because the link is where we have health messages and where we have public education, and what is it that we must do to reach out to those. It was in that respect that We're drawing that link. Just on malaria, I was just trying to correct you. On the EH, what I was saying is that we haven't lost our status as EH. It's just that we had to postpone. We could have reached this by 2020, so we'll be there in 2023, for instance. I think it was in that respect. The one share that you're raising about the link between the visits and the opportunity to increase access to services. Maybe, Dr. Pile, as part of our package of services that we are reorganizing for primary health care and these district health management organizations. In fact, Chair, I'm surprised you didn't ask about the district specialist teams that were supporting the programs, because it's another intervention that, an intervention that we introduced. So we probably have to go back and look at what other services these women can access. We did a pilot in Mpumalanga, and I think it was three provinces, where we had an integrated approach to care, not just for those who attended our antenatal clinics. It was also to reduce the burden on the users of services, because we had historically we're planning services in such a way that people must come to services according to how we see those services, not according to reducing the reduction of the burden on them, particularly on how they access services. Firstly, we'll organize HIV on a Monday, hypertension on a Wednesday, and diabetes. So we said with integration, a person must just come once and have a full package of services in the same way as we organizing that for antenatal care. But I guess it's logical because we've already done that. Maybe it will increase our figures from 70% to 80%. Hopefully, Chair. We hope it will go up to 80%. The flow of money, the CFO has responded. I hope I've covered most of it. Mr. Ren.
Ms. Rennie completes their responses. You have another 10 minutes to do the other presentation. Yeah, and I'm aware that members would like to be wrapping up at least by 3:15.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I'll be very short. Chair asked about the case at Eastern Cape, the Mthatha case of that lawyer. The latest update on that matter is that he's been arrested twice on 6 different cases with the cost implications of about 200 million, and he's out on bail.
We must also acknowledge that it was started by our former MEC.
Thank you very much, Chanting. We will take you back there. No, no, we are here now. Can you then take us to the presentation?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. This is just an overview, Chair, of the entities. These are very important entities for us because they support our work, but they also respond to particular services. I can categorize them as research, regulatory, service-oriented, but also statutory. So the sort of those broad categories. And you may want at some stage to have the health profession-related statutory institutions, because they have implications for our work, like your nursing council, health professions council, and so on, because they don't get funded through fiscus, but they're an important kind of stakeholder group that support our work as well, that have perform a very important regulatory function. So for this chair, I'll just talk about roughly their strategic goals, budget, achievements, risks, and challenges. So there are 5 of them, and all 5 are listed as a Schedule 3A public entities in terms of PFME and its Council for Medical Skin, NHLS, Office of Health Standard Compliance, SAPRA, as well as MRC. So for CMS, the significance, and I think because of the current debate on NHI, it's probably one entity that you're going to take interest in. Because they regulate medical skin and to ensure that they are properly governed, and also that the fairness, transparency, and
if I may interrupt you, as you go to like that first one, indicate to us if the leader is here, what is his name, what is her name, if they are here. Just to remind us here.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think it was an oversight. We've got here present Dr. Sabani, who is the CEO. Thank you. So, Chair, if you look at the budget, they will present this in sufficient detail, and when they come and present, this is just an overview an advance copy for you to prepare for when they come. But I think I wanted to talk more about the risks and challenges. That's where you might want to give a special attention. You might have heard about a PNB. They need to tell you about the PNBs when they come, as well as the low-cost benefit option, which has been an area of controversy. Prescribed minimum benefits. Yes, they will explain that. But also the low-cost benefit option, and so what you intended, what does it mean, what are the implications of any time, so you need to get into those kind of discussions. The next one is that one of consolidating schemes that have less than 6,000 members. You know, even that one, what does it mean, what are the implications, government-funded schemes, their consolidation, risk-based capital solvency framework, because we know that there's a certain solvency level that is regulated, and what does it mean? So I'm raising this because they're going to be very important questions when they come, and you need to also understand this is in the context of NHI. The mechanism to reduce costs and what their role is in quality improvement, particularly for the private health sector, and ways by which they can reduce fraud, waste and abuse. You saw the headlines about racial profiling, what does it mean, and the hearings that have been underway, the governance and financial management of schemes, those that have been placed under curatorship, complaints that have been lodged by various parties. You know, I think those are sort of key pointed issues, so I just lifted those, including with compliance with the supply chain issues. But I think it's probably one particular regulated environment that has been able to bring about a certainty in the sense that the schemes have maintained an average solvency of about 33%. If you recall, the statutory requirement is 25%. So it means at least those who contribute towards Medicare scheme can sleep at night, that they won't be told that the scheme can't meet its commitment. The PMBs at the moment and the review that is currently underway is meant to help us come up with a service-based package instead of the current process of a diagnosis-based list. But also, historically, you may know that our schemes did not necessarily make reference to primary health care. At least for now, there's special focus and attention to preventative and primary health care package and alignment with what is needed for NHI. So the next one, Chair, is NHLS. So she'll send again, linking her to NHLS. You'll recall that NHLS was established in 2000, with 268 labs in 9 provinces, but it's also an important training platform for our pathology labs personnel, and it's highly acclaimed for its superior academic team. In fact, Chairman, this is the only time that I'll blow a horn, but about the country, in that our own horn, that when there was an outbreak in West Africa, we were the first country to go there and set up a lab to support the people of Sierra Leone and use that as a basis of training. Firstly, and secondly, we are the only country in the continent with a BSL-4. Lab. Now, this is a lab that handles a highly contagious pathogen. The stuff that you should not see outside because it's in countries that are naughty. They use this for biowarfare. So it is a highly specialized area. But it's a high scientific institution that we have in the country. We train academic scientists, medical technologies, but they have very good systems of surveillance, particularly for communicable diseases, occupational health, and we also have a cancer registry. And like you recall that there's been a sort of a mechanism by which we recognize the work that MRC does and they do, but their specialty has been more on communicable diseases. So, Chair, with the amendment to the law and the NAPISA that I've been referring to repeatedly, the idea was to actually split the function of the lab and that of an institution that should provide surveillance and ensure that we can comply with our international health regulations and respond when there are hazards and also risks that we are confronted with. So, Chair, this is the budget. And as you know, NHLS was one institution that always came here and showed red in their books. And now they have a surplus, and thanks to Dr. Chetty, that there's now a surplus, and we can sleep comfortably at night. But the risks, Chair, as you know, constraints due to the mismatch of service and previous political structure, the baskets of tests that must be rendered, particularly either at primary healthcare level, hospital level, so that you don't end up having any tests anywhere at huge costs. But it's also either tests are done too late, or inappropriate tests are conducted, or either, you know, they're in a, you know, not at an appropriate level. So, but they've done quite a good background work by identifying what kind of tests are conducted at TAC level. Because what used to happen is that you used to have duplicate tests at huge cost to the provinces, and also not, you know, getting results on time, and failure to keep pace with international trends and standardization. But I think most of these things have been dealt with for us, in that they've managed to have about 99 of their facilities accredited, and they continue to be high-end institution, not only for training, for rendering services. They even got won an award internationally, and they also have a cancer registry. There's been some stability, like I say, from having a 1.8 billion deficit to a 1.4 billion surplus. It's a huge achievement. To be honest, we still want to know how they did it so that we can gather. But we're really proud of this achievement. But we'd like to see that as an opportunity also to invest in surveillance so that we can respond timely to diseases. The next one is Office of Hospital Compliance Chair. Yeah. He's not the CEO. He's here on behalf of him. You'll know, Chair, that this is a very important entity that is meant to ensure that quality is ensured through enforcement of certain standards that have been developed, but in particular, to deal with the safety concerns. We also have to have a system where there are complaints investigated. But they don't just stop with investigation, but action must be taken. In fact, when this law was passed, honorable members, there was a debate about what punitive measures should be put in place. You know, where there's been a consistent and repeated failure of the system. And this is probably one institution that will be a precursor towards how quality will be determined in preparation for NHI, and they're going to play a very significant role for that. They've been responsive, as you know, their reports have been made public, they'll be coming to Parliament also to present their report in partnership with the Ombud. They work collaboratively, but they also have inherent mandates prescribed in law individually, like the office as well as the Ombud. But they're important institutions for the improvement of quality and safety. With the Ombud, you probably have seen the report, particularly with many reports, but also there's been a debate here that the way the law is written, you must actually separate the office and the Ombud, and you'll probably have an opportunity to see those two bills presented. In fact, when the both were created, we amended the National Health Act, and there's been a debate as to whether should we have rather created the office so that they have their own law, and they're not just the subset of the National Health Act, as if it's an appendage or something. So there's been that debate. So we've got draft bills that will bring to Parliament for both the Ombud and the office in that respect. And this is the budget, and this they will come and present, Chair. The risks, they say inadequate visibility, Chair, I don't think so, because they've been in every paper. If you don't comply, the results are made public. Maybe they were made popular by Parliament, because it's Parliament that calls them and say we want to do it. They still want more standards and also, you know, adequate governance system. And I think where we've seen a gap is just feedback to the public, because when they release the results and say these facilities comply, the public would like to know which ones, are they ours or not? So it's a link between their results and the users of services. This is the gap that we've seen. But they've actually achieved quite a lot in that they've inspected 730 facilities, and they've got a call center, and they actually respond speedily. If you send a query, a complaint, they respond. It's a very a good system. And public awareness, and they've also had a consultative workshop. They're busy now drafting norms and standards for emergency medical services, because people complain that ambulances take long. So as a measure and a norm and a standard, they would like to have that area regulated. The next one is SAPRA. This is the regulatory agency that's responsible for regulating medicines, make sure they meet standards of quality, efficacy, and safety. And they also help oversee the regulation of radiation-emitting devices and radioactive substances, like your nuclides and so on, and ionizing radiation material, as well as the relative sources. Well, I think one of the things that they will share with you is that because they're an infant, newly formed baby, we have a doctor, she will also come with the chair to just share with you what is it that they do. We've got a very huge responsibility. Every medicine, every device, complementary medicine must be regulated by them, and they have to ensure that they meet standards of quality, efficacy, and safety. They regulate clinical trials. They have to ensure that there are no unregistered products on the market. They must also have a safety program called pharmacovigilance to ensure that once medicines are approved and they're on the market, that they continue to be safe. And it's a huge responsibility. And this is their budget. You can see they don't have a lot of lines. They're big, they're new, like others who've been around for a while. Their risks are that they would like to digitize, but I think the biggest one is the backlog.
Yes.
You'll probably get a lot of people complaining. They'll come and tell you how they're dealing with the backlog.
Sure.
And the kind of resources they need to increase their capacity, because they really, really need to make investment in their personnel to ensure that they can perform their functions and meet our needs, our public health needs, while ensuring that we also have a productive industry that can produce medicines that can compete also internationally. So at least now they've registered the formulations for TB, ARVs. They now have 195 products that were registered. They're busy clearing backlog. They'll come and talk about that. They've introduced some digital systems, and they say they've got 20 applicants for cultivation of cannabis. Chair, I would like us to come and just share with you what is it that's happening in that particular area, because the cannabis issue and its derivatives, as well as hemp, are not just SAPRA, and it's about agriculture, trade and industry, science and technology. It's actually a multi-stakeholder involvement. In fact, we just finished a big meeting last week, including farmers. We've got a report that we'll come and present here in Parliament. South African Medical Research Council, we've got both the chair and the CEO, the president. It's an institution that we pride ourselves in, because most of our reports, as you notice, we reference them, because they do analysis for us, the basis on which we plan, on which we respond. There's scientific excellence, and it's probably one of, you know, I think they're great in the room, the oldest institution when I compare to others. Others have been created over the number of years. So we just start, you know, I refer to a baby, and now we come to the geriatric MRC. Yes, so this is their budget, and Chair, you've already mentioned that you'll be visiting them. They, of course, say that they need to deal with their continuity program and ensure that they continue to have research integrity, because the products that come out of MRC are really, really good. And internationally, it's one of the institutions that's highly respected. They must still deal with the collaborative partnerships with others. They support our universities as well in conducting research. So they've actually done quite a lot. In fact, we've been saying that if we find a cure for AIDS, it must come out of this institution. If they don't, then they fail. But of course, they translate research into findings, and also provide innovation and technology. And one of the areas on tech transfer, on how we can translate our research products into a commercialization and response to our public health problems. I thank you, Chair.
Thanks, DG. Thanks to the leaders of these various entities who are here. It is nice to place a face to the institution. We may not really thoroughly engage with you now, but this highlight is assisting us in preparation for when we meet with you. Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you again. I think it's been quite an interesting and well-presented day. I just have a couple of queries, and one of them is that one that we are being really burdened with, and I'm sure that many of my colleagues here will agree with you, is licensing. Lots of people, private hospitals, going through, it's taking them, they've been on this process for 2 years. Documentation keeps changing, and we that cannot get hold, or we're not being directed to anybody who can assist. It's licensing of hospitals, clinics, dispensing licenses. Those three particularly seem to have become a total nightmare for people who are trying to help the health sector. That's one of the biggest issues, and I am concerned, ma'am, because you do know that the NAPISA bill went to NCOP, came back to Parliament, and it lapsed on the 7th of May. It was not signed off by the President on time. It lapsed on the 7th of May, unfortunately, in terms of the NA rules of 3332. So, Chair, we're going to have to do something to bring that back quite quickly. There was not great opposition to that bill, and I think it's something that we need to address quite quickly. Sorry, I've got... I think that's the two main issues. Please, if we can just get clarity on what is the holdup in licensing. Because people, I'm literally dealing with 30, 40 entities, businesses, farmers a day who've built clinics for their staff in big farming communities where some of them are trying to treat, you know, up to 1,300, 1,500 of their workers that established the clinic can't get the licenses. If you can just put us in the right direction, thank you.
Thanks, Gigi. So the licenses are coordinated at provincial level, so it'll be useful to understand which province it is where the license holdups are, so that we can try and facilitate to understand where the problem is exactly. So hospital licenses and facility licenses are issued at a provincial level. So each provincial department has its own process as such, which is an issue the Health Market Inquiry highlighted, so we need to fix the process because it's all different across the country. That's obviously a problem for an applicant. You know.
Okay. If we can keep you here for long, because I was listening to, I don't want you to answer this. Why we, among other things, we want to see SAPRA because of the cannabis story and your story and also the issue of they've admitted publicly there's a backlog in terms of region. So all that we need to get to. So I think we'll sort it out when we meet with them, which is going to happen quite soon. Within for a fortnight, we'll have met with them. Colleagues, if there's any pressing question, now, can I get any pressing question that you have?
Honourable Scus,
then Honourable
Tendu, the choir. Honourable Chair, just need to guide me with this question. It's one that the DG referred to earlier, that the HPCSA works together with the department to ensure that the objectives are met. We have a case now where a doctor has waited 2.5 years for a disciplinary hearing to happen. How does the department deal with those kind of backlogs where we already have health professionals that limited health professionals in the country and especially with a young doctor?
Okay. My question is about we have a number of nurses who have qualified even through the university. But they cannot be, it's a problem for them to be registered there in Pretoria. We have also tried to get them registered, but I'm telling you, no one is ready to help them. So who is the next person that we can contact who can help the poor nurses to be registered?
I'm happy, Chair, they have got the two DDGs here. The licensing of facilities, pharmacy, Dr. Tito, and the statutory body, Dr. Jason. So all these questions must be directed to them, they must be able to deal with them yesterday.
Sir, and it's aimed at the OHSC. Sir. When we're talking about norms and standards, we had a situation in Ephraim Mahali 2 months ago. A 78-year-old woman fell, broke her femur. Right at the top, couldn't put her in a cast. She needed surgery, plates, pins, etc. She lay in traction for 7.5 weeks. She was transported twice to the Philadelphia Hospital and returned. She was transported 6 times to the Mankweng Hospital and returned without being attended to. It was only on her 7th visit when we were there to meet that ambulance and insist that she gets admitted and operated on 2 days later. There must be something that governs that. Apart from the fact that you have disproportional, misappropriation of funds, irregular expenditure. That can't be. I mean, it was an entire crew, it was an entire nurse, it was an ambulance who made 8 trips
for 77.5 weeks she lay in traction before somebody would attend her. We eventually got the NSC involved, who said she must be admitted. The doctor in the hospital, in the orthopedic ward at Monk Wing Hospital, said, "I don't care what the NSC says. I don't have a bed, she's going back." These are issues that really, really seriously need to be attended to, because that is just not. And she was actually told in the orthopedic ward at Monk Wing, she was lucky she was operated on, although because she's 78. They have a standard at the moment when anyone who is 72 or older gets put to the back of the list. And I think that's a concern. And just quickly on medical research. I know that we have permission to use DDT in this country to fight malaria. Okay, I understand that. But we suddenly see a spike in malaria and we're suddenly using a hell of a lot more DDT than we did in the past. Do we have an idea of what the effects are of increasing DDT, which has serious health repercussions, as to our fight against malaria? Do we have a balance or a picture on that? Because DDT basically is internationally banned. Thank you.
A food for thought we won't answer today. Prepare that to be answered next time. Okay. Yeah, colleagues, I'm trying to bring this meeting to a close because there are certain other pressures that are coming in now that we are not aware of. But I'd like to thank the department. DG and your team have prepared so thoroughly. And for us, this has been a great opportunity to understand what we are doing, bringing the other colleagues who are leading the entities. We are up for the job now. We have been able to engage with them and therefore bring you. But we'll really appeal to you in your own words that in the next presentation, we'll have to get you to come back. Will be two specific issues that you want to deal with. If you spend 3/4 of the time on the mental health status in the country, that would be well and good. Close that presentation with the oncology services in the country. I think if you can take that chunk, colleagues, that might just be sufficient to take us from 9 o'clock until 1 o'clock and then with questions. That's a big chunk. So we might as well indicate to you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, the meeting is at 10 o'clock tomorrow. After 10:30 tomorrow at Good Hope, Good Hope Chamber, somewhere this side. Walking.